by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting U of I students in the plays Brecht on Brecht and Dickens' Great Expectations, in premieres and reconstructed dance works in Festival 2005, and in Leonard Bernstein's opera Candide with guest alum Jerry Hadley. For more information or tickets, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls, Henry Frayne. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Virginia Dejean Anderson. She is an historian, associate professor of history at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and we will be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in her book, Creatures of Empire, and the subtitle here tells it all, How Domestic Animals Transformed Early America. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And here is the way that she writes about the book and what she's interested in, right within the first couple of pages. She writes this: Historical narratives usually attribute the course of events to the conscious decisions of human actors, yet this is not always the way in which history itself unfolded. Sometimes other kinds of actors were involved, driven by instinct rather than reason. Such was the case in 17th century America, where the lives of Indians and colonists alike often were shaped in unexpected ways by the activities of animals. This book, by incorporating livestock into the history of early America, restores an important element of contingency to the narrative, making it less familiar, but no less compelling. As we talk about some of these ideas, so you're certainly invited to call in. You folks who are listening, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief and do that so we can keep the program moving. But anyone who is listening is welcome to call. In Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, the number 333-9455. We do also have the toll-free line. That's good anyway that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, if you have questions or comments, you want to be involved with the conversation, you can do that. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Anderson, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
I'm interested and quite intrigued, really, with this kind of basic premise on which the whole project rests, and that is that in doing history, we do tend to focus on the activities of people, of humans, and of course, rightly so. But one cannot ignore the environment. It has a way of shaping history. It has a way of directing the story in one, down one road as opposed to another that it might go. And to me, I think that it's interesting that now apparently within the field of history, there are more and more historians that are taking those things into account.
That's absolutely true. And what's interesting is I never really identified myself as an environmental historian until I got onto this project. And so I think even people who might think of themselves as traditional historians are now paying close attention to that very theme about the environment. And what interested me in particular about animals is what I try to argue in the book is they're not simply part of the environment, although they certainly have an impact on the environment in early America, but in some measure they're historical actors because they move around and do things, and they do things on their own volition that humans can't control.
Mm-hmm. And that's an important part of the story here and something that we will talk about. But I guess here a central idea is that, and one might not think about it, but that livestock, by their actions, gave, you know, created an opportunity for a conflict between the native people and the European colonists. And I guess you could think of a lot of different reasons, I suppose, that there would be conflict. And I suppose one of the first things I would think about would be, well, land, territory. We're fighting over that. And that certainly is related. But having the animals be a focus of the conflict would not have been something that I probably would have thought about, and I expect a lot of other people wouldn't either.
Right, and it operates on a number of levels. As you mentioned, it's a big issue about land. The human colonists who come over occupy land, and that leads to friction with the Indians, but the domestic animals that those colonists bring with them also occupy land, and actually more land than the human colonists themselves do. And so you do find opportunities for friction, trespass cases, things like that. They're also conceptual concerns that lead to friction in that the colonists are bringing over animals that they consider to be property, and the notion of living animals as property is a concept that is essentially foreign to native peoples. And so they have to come to terms not only with the environmental impact of animals, the competition over land, but also come to terms with a whole new conception about what an animal can be.
Yeah. Well, that is really where the meat of the story starts, with your exploring these two kinds of views of animals, that is the European view and then the native view. But before going to that, I guess I'm also interested in the fact that apparently, as you explain in the book, is the way this started was as an attempt to understand why it is that in so much of the documents that we have that relate to early American history, there are so many references to animals and not wild animals, to domestic animals. What is it that you find?
Well, this was where, as I said in the introduction, the project got going, because I originally intended the book to be a history of livestock husbandry in early America. And then I discovered that whenever there were mentions of cows or pigs or horses in the records, there were often comments about Indians alongside it. And so it was looking at that puzzle, why those two pieces of evidence would be appearing side by side so frequently, that launched me on the project. But I think the animals appear so frequently because they are so essential to the process of colonization. I don't think the English could have been even remotely as successful as they were in settling the New World had they not brought animals with them. And the same story goes, of course, for other European groups, the French, the Spanish, and so forth, who come to the New World, although the book just deals with the English. And because these animals are so essential and, in fact, outnumber the human colonists, that it's almost inevitable that they would show up sooner or later. But the sorts of sources they're showing up in are not just court records, but laws. Almost any kind of source you can find about 17th century America has animals, domestic animals, in there one place or another. And again, I think it's a signal about how significant these animals were to the colonists. This is a point that I often try to bring out in my classes here at the university, because at least, most of us in urban or suburban areas don't have much contact with cows or pigs or horses, at least directly, and we tend to forget that in times past, these were absolutely critical to the communities of human beings who occupied the land.
Mm-hmm. One other, important point, something for people to keep in mind that you also comment on here just early on in the first few pages, is the role that the native people, the Indian people, played in the story of colonization. And it is often the case that they, as the story has been written, and certainly as it has been written by European American historians, that it seems that often they're cast as passive actors, the story acted upon them, not so much that they were active in writing that story, and it is the fact that they were active in making that story, and that the two worlds, the world of the European colonists and the world of the native people, while they were separate, they were really very tangled up together, and that is something that, it's an important feature of this story, and probably as we try to understand that time, that is something that we really need to keep in mind.
Oh, absolutely. And many of the negotiations that I describe between Indians and colonists over animals, it's Indians negotiating as well to try to figure out ways to solve the situation that preserves their own cultural integrity or autonomy as best they can. We tend to forget, again, because we know how this story turns out. It's also very easy to assume that the Indians are at some point going to disappear, and of course they have never disappeared. That's a myth in and of itself. But it's sometimes difficult to remember that for really much of the first century of colonization, Indians are virtually equal partners. I don't know that I would go quite that far, but are very active in political situations, military alliances, trade. and so forth. They're very much in the picture, if not fully represented in the source material, which, as you say, is produced by European colonists.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Virginia DeJohn Anderson. She's an historian at University of Colorado Boulder, and she is an author of a book that takes a look at the role that domestic animals played in the making of early America. The title of her book is Creatures of Empire, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. And it's very interesting. It's out now, and if you'd like to take a look at it, you can seek it out. And, of course, your questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I think probably an important couple of important key ideas to get across here or to discuss at this point. It goes back to the point you made a little bit earlier, and that is that the Native Americans and the European colonists, the way that they looked at the natural world and particularly the way that they looked at animals were very different because the Native people didn't have domestic animals, and the whole idea that you could do such a thing was kind of foreign to them. And the Europeans, though, they had a very different sort of view and particularly had this kind of idea that somehow animal husbandry, having domesticated animals, was a mark of civilization. It was progress. And also that they had this idea, and I know I realize I'm laying a lot of stuff out here really quick, but they had this idea also that if the Indians could do that, then they would also progress. They had this idea that the Indians should just get with the program and do things like they did, and apparently had a difficult time understanding why it is the Indians thought that was kind of odd because it just wasn't part of their experience. So let's talk about those things. Well, first of all, talk about the Native American attitude toward nature and toward animals.
Okay. The Indians really operated within the context of a very different cosmology, which is, again, to say a view of the world, humans' place within the world and nature. And they tend not to recognize a sharp distinction between the natural and supernatural world. And so it was understood that what, you know, we would identify as elements of the natural environment, whether it's trees, rivers, or animals, could have spiritual power. And because these animals had spiritual power, they were not identified as being subordinate to humans in any way, that humans exercised dominion over them. And because animals were thought to have spiritual power, humans who wished to interact with them, most specifically in terms of hunting them, had to respect that spiritual power. So we find, for instance, in the case of hunting, that Indians believed that you couldn't just go out and hunt an animal successfully without first making a gesture, an overture, often in a ritualized sort of way, to the spiritual protector of an animal. And then if you perform the proper rituals, then you would in effect receive permission to hunt that particular animal. And often you would have to enact certain rituals afterwards. One of the most important was if you successfully hunted an animal, slaughtered it, that you treated the bones in the right way, burned them, or in some cultures, hung them from a tree so that they couldn't be desecrated by dogs or other animals. And so the notion really was almost a partnership between human beings and the animal world, not dominion on the part of the humans.
So when it was that the Native people first encountered these animals that the Europeans brought, sheep and pigs and cows, did they, obviously they knew what they were, but because they would have been different from the wild animals that they would have been familiar with and would have hunted, did they in a sense recognize that they were the same, or did they somehow in their minds think that they were in some important way different from wild animals? I mean, how did they think about these two categories, the wild animals and the domesticated animals?
It's a sort of learning process over the course of early colonization. What looks like a fairly common process among Indians who first encounter English animals is they certainly recognize them as non-human creatures, but precisely what they are, they're not sure. And what happens at the start with the initial contacts between these Indians and domestic animals, often, I should say, these contacts occur without any colonists being around to kind of negotiate the process. Indians attempt to assess the animal, its behavior, its appearance, and incorporate it into their own world on their own terms. So, for instance, we find very fragmentary evidence that suggests that Indians assumed that these domestic animals must also have some sort of spiritual power when they were trying to figure out what to call them. The initial process was to try to find an analogous animal, indigenous animal. And the best example of this is when the Narragansetts first saw pigs, they tried to figure out, you know, what is this pig? And they analyzed the behavior of the animal, its size, and so on, and decided a pig was most like a woodchuck. So they used the Narragansett word for woodchuck initially to describe pigs. So at the start, I think Indians attempt to say, okay, these are different animals, but we can find a place for them in our own way of seeing the world. That is not that's not a process the colonists are going to accept, because in effect what the Indians are doing is incorporating these animals as a new form of game, which means they're free for the taking. And so the colonists insist that the Indians recognize these animals as being different. And as that process goes on, in the first decades of colonization, one of the indicators of this is the Indians begin to change the terms they use to describe the animals. They don't call pigs woodchucks anymore. They call them pigs, or the word pig with a Narragansett suffix stuck onto it, so it's a kind of hybrid word, English Narragansett word. But I think that linguistic change symbolizes this learning process, as I say, on the part of Indians, that they can't just incorporate these animals in their own way. They do have to recognize they're different. And, of course, eventually to recognize that these animals, unlike indigenous animals, are property, and they can't just hunt them at will.
Well, obviously there was a central point of conflict, because to the Europeans, if you saw a cow just kind of wandering around loose, you probably would assume that it belonged to someone, because you have this idea that animals can belong to someone. But the native people, if that really wasn't their idea, it was, you know, if they saw a deer wandering out, they could feel free to hunt that, because that doesn't really belong to anybody. And how difficult was it for them to understand and accept that idea that there are wild animals, and that's one category, but there are these other animals, and that's a completely different thing?
Well, it seems as if it's pretty difficult from the number of cases we see in early judicial records, court records, where Indians are brought into English colonial courts and charged with killing an animal that has been designated as property. I think the Indians learn fairly quickly not to go out and deliberately shoot an animal. The difficulty comes when Indians set traps in the woods to hunt deer and other native animals, because, in fact, much Indian hunting is through trapping, not shooting with bows and arrows. And a cow wanders through. I mean, it's not the Indian's fault that the cow happens to step into the trap, but then the Indian is still charged with destruction of property, even if it was an accidental situation like that. So I think it takes a bit of time for Indians to learn about this, but because the consequences are severe enough if they get caught, that they do learn it. But the friction continues with cases of trespass and of accidental death of animals, because as far as the English are concerned, these are not accidents, and the Indians must be held liable.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation, someone in Mahomet nearby, not too far away. Let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Thank you. Good morning. I guess I had two thoughts. One was, I wonder if you'd address like the concept of domestic animals, and didn't the Indians have dogs? And then, if I just go on with this, was there interbreeding of the dogs, and of that thing about the dogs? And then, isn't this to some extent a conflict that's like between an agrarian and a hunter gatherer society, to the extent that like there's always that conflict?
Okay, the two points here. First, about dogs. Mm-hmm. It's true that Indians had dogs, and I've been using the term Indians all the way through this conversation, but I should be specific here. In the book, I deal with Algonquian Indians on the East Coast. And they did have dogs, And one could argue that these were semi-domesticated, but typically when people look at animal domestication, the animals are being specifically raised for specific purposes. And while native peoples in other parts of North America use dogs for hunting, for carrying burdens, and so on, the evidence for the Eastern Algonquian suggests that the dog's function, if you will, in Indian villages was extremely attenuated. They were scavengers. They may have been a kind of early warning system, barking when an intruder appeared. And they may have been used for hunting, but it's not quite clear. So, yes, the dog is probably the one exception here. But the Indian dogs among the Algonquians were not what we would typically recognize as fully domesticated, certainly. And what was interesting to me is I found no evidence that when Indians saw pigs or cows or whatever, that they drew any kind of analogy to dogs. It was always to another wild animal. Okay, so that's the first part. The second part, and the interbreeding, interbreeding between what?
European dogs and Native American dogs?
There may have
been. Is that going on?
There may have been. This is not the sort of thing that English colonists wrote down about, so
right.
I think it's hard to find out.
Sure.
The other point about an agrarian versus a hunter-gatherer culture,
mm-hmm.
The native peoples of the East Coast farmed. They raised crops on a certain portion of their land and combined farming with hunting and gathering, so that it's not quite an agrarian culture against a hunter-gatherer one. It's an agrarian culture without domestic animals versus an agrarian culture with domestic animals, I think is a better way to see it. And the colonists recognized that the Indians did do some farming, and one of the concessions they were willing to make at one point in the encounters of the early decades was to help Indians build fences around their cornfields to help keep domestic animals out. Indians had never had to build fences because if a deer or whatever gets in your cornfield, you shoot it. It's only when you have domestic animals in the environment that it becomes a problem. And so it's two different agrarian cultures, I would say, coming together, and it's the domestic animals that create the problem.
Also interesting concept. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And that's just an illustration of yet another of these points of conflict between the native people and the European colonists, is that the Europeans brought the animals, and the Europeans were very busy. They had all kinds of things that they had tried to do as they were trying to build places to live and establish a life, and sometimes the animals were just left to kind of fend for themselves, and as they will, they'll wander around, they'll look for stuff to eat, and they had this way of wandering into the farm fields of the Indians and eating, which made the Indians extremely unhappy, and no doubt also led in some of those cases to Indian shooting animals. I mean, if a cow wandered into your cornfield and started eating up your crop, you're going to do something about it. So here it was again yet another way that the two groups of people came into conflict as a result of the actions of a result of the animals doing what it is they naturally do.
Exactly. And one of the Indian responses to this is often, if they couldn't solve the problem, well, I should backtrack and say one of the things that's interesting is, at least initially, colonists recognized this as a problem, and an Indian could also go to the English authorities with evidence of damage in the field and sometimes get recompense from the owner of the livestock. So there's friction here, but there are also attempts to smooth over the friction with typically English legal procedures. So there is that, but Indians will often just respond by moving away. But as you say, the animals are not well cared for, and so what happens is the animals sort of move out, and when Indians move 2, 3, 4 miles away from English settlements, they find that the animals still make it into their cornfields. And so as we move further into the 17th century, Indians are getting quite frustrated because it's as if there's no place they can go where they can get away from these creatures.
Mm-hmm. Two, we talked a little bit about the native people's view of animals and the natural world, and maybe I should give you the opportunity to do the same about the Europeans. And in one sense, you would have to think that the Europeans really weren't far enough from their pre-Christian years to have completely gotten rid of a similar kind of understanding about animals. And yet, I suppose here the operative force here is Christianity in changing the way and in setting up this sort of opposing view of the world as being something that was there for human beings to manage and to use, which was not something that the native people would have, certainly not a way the native people would have seen it.
Right. The predominant framework within which English colonists viewed the role of animals was the Christian framework, was the material from Genesis, where the Lord gives humans dominion over the creatures of the earth and to use as they will. And certainly this is the key to domestication. Domestication is in many ways just a legal expression of human dominion over animals. And this is clearly, as I say, the dominant way that colonists thought about the relationship between humans and animals. What I also found, though, is this undertone of pre-Christian ideas that are expressed most directly in residual folklore about animals, that animals can predict the weather, that a stork leaving the chimney of a house presages the death of someone living in the house, that this folklore lingers in England. And in some ways, the folklore would have been a closer match to the Indian cosmology regarding animals than the Christian one. But this folkloric element in English culture is really diminishing at precisely the time that colonization occurs, particularly in the context of the Protestant Reformation. And so it doesn't operate to act as a point of contact between English culture and Indian culture. And in fact, it complicates matters in some ways because there is an analogy in English culture that might link up with Indian views of animals, but it's not one that's going to create good relations between the two. And I think the closest analogy I could find was in English witchcraft, where the belief was that witches were often accompanied by little diabolical helpers that took the shape of animals. And hence, any notion of animals and spiritual power from the English side was evil, was diabolical. And to the extent to which they saw Indian descriptions, relations, explanations of animals with spiritual power, the English, would probably see that as diabolical. And in fact, the English were prone to describe Indian religion as witchcraft. There is this non-Christian undertone on the English side, but it doesn't serve to smooth things over with Indians.
I'm sure that in the years of early America that the European colonists had to engage in some subsistence hunting. What did they think about hunting?
Hunting in English culture was thought to be more of a sport. It was generally associated with aristocrats in England, men of leisure who hunted in their own deer parks and so on. And so hunting, from the English point of view, is tied up in notions of hierarchy. Again, there were game laws in England that restricted who could hunt and who couldn't hunt. Hunting was associated with property rights because rights to hunt were connected with ownership of land. People could hunt on land they owned, but not elsewhere, and typically those who owned land were aristocrats. So what it did is tend to make English colonists who observed Indians hunting to associate Indian hunters with men of leisure, which is, of course, not, hunting is a subsistence activity among Native Americans, so it leads to a point of confusion. And this characterization of Indian men as, lazy, which is the description that's used in a lot of the records, is based on this idea of hunting as leisure, also is based on a misunderstanding of the gendered division of labor among Indians, because in most Native societies, Indian women carry out the work of horticulture, farming, and then the men hunt. And in English culture, of course, men do the bulk of agricultural work. And so this experience with hunting in England tended to make Indians look, make English colonists look at Indians and say, well, the women are doing all the work and the men are just out there having fun hunting. So hunting creates, again, another sort of set of cultural misunderstandings. One other element I would just want to throw in here is that it's not clear how much subsistence hunting colonists actually did. Hmm. Particularly in New England, it doesn't seem like colonists did much hunting at all. There was maybe some in the South in the Chesapeake, but what you often find, again, scattered evidence for, is that what colonists did was hire Indians to hunt because the Indians were better at it than the English. The colonists who were coming over are not, by and large, aristocrats with any kind of hunting experience. And so they often found it more efficient to have Indians do that job for them.
We have some other callers, some people who would like to get in on the conversation. We'll go next to a caller in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I hope it's not too much too quick, but my vision of the West and the buffalo herds, then the introduction of domesticated cattle and the conflict there, and then as as agrarian types moved to the West, I'm thinking of the Oklahoma land rush, and then the conflicts between cattle barons and the homesteader, and I wonder if you have covered any of that.
That's really well beyond the confines of the time period that I cover in my book. Okay. But one of the things I do argue is that if you want to think about Western expansion even after the American Revolution as a form of colonization by Euro-Americans, it's done by Euro-American people plus livestock and creates certainly conflicts with native peoples and, as you suggest, conflicts among Europeans or Euro-Americans with different kinds of subsistence practices. So it's like a later chapter of the story that I have chapter one of.
Thank you.
All right. Then I think that is an important point that you seem to be arguing is that the kind of pattern that we have seen that one sees here in early America in these particular places along the eastern seaboard is repeated. As the Europeans move west.
Oh, exactly. And also in other colonies. When I was working on this project, one of the things that was interesting is I kept finding similar sorts of stories in South Carolina, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, and I gave brief thought to covering it on a larger expanse, larger geographical expanse, but then tried to figure out if I could ever finish the book before I retired, so limited it to the 17th century East Coast. But it is the same story, because Europeans, European Americans, cannot conceive of settling the land without livestock husbandry. It is so embedded in their own culture that they cannot imagine not having it. And so it is these animals accompany Europeans wherever they go. Yeah. The same stories in Australia and New Zealand.
And that's, I guess, again, we made this point more than once, but I do think that it's important that there is, in the minds of the Europeans, there's this link between civilization and progress and domestic animals and animal husbandry. And interestingly, also Christianity. All four of those things they're all holding hands.
Right, and it is so much of an assumption, they don't even feel that it's necessary to explain the connection. And I have an excellent example for how this works. In one of the chapters, I discussed this wolf bounty law that was passed in Virginia. Now, of course, wolves are predators, and they prey on domestic animals, and so the colonists wanted to get rid of as many wolves as possible. One of the things they thought would be a useful tactic is to hire Indians to kill the wolves for them. And in this case in Virginia, this act was encouraging Indians to hunt wolves, but the reward they would get for doing so was very interesting. It was a cow. And the statute basically says, essentially for every 8 wolves' heads, I think it is, that the Indians bring in, they'll get a cow because it will bring them to civility and Christianity. Something like it was just a blanket statement, didn't explain why. But when you look into this subject a little bit more, you can see the connections that were unconscious on the part of the English. First of all, again, having domesticated animals is an expression of dominion, of human dominion over animals, which is sanctioned by Scripture. So there's the connection to Christianity. But also that livestock husbandry was thought to inculcate certain kinds of behavior that were identified as civil. People who owned animals were prudent. They were good stewards of creatures in the land. It was thought they rose early in the morning and worked hard all day and took care of these creatures. And so it was thought that these behavioral aspects were also integral to civility. And it's so bound up there that that the colonists never even questioned this, that a culture without domestic animals could be civil. Roger Williams, the well-known founder of Rhode Island at one point, is urging, as you say, urging Indians to acquire these animals, and he's very blatant about it. He says they will move from barbarism to civility mm-hmm. by having cows.
Let's talk with someone else, a listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Your description of the English settlers' attitude toward hunting is really interesting because the English are probably only separated by 250 years from a period when hunting was strictly for the nobility, but not exactly for sport. It was to prepare, acquire meat for the nobility's table, because there weren't large numbers of meat animals. The animals were largely beasts of burden, and they were only slaughtered in the fall of the year when the surplus animals were butchered, and the meat would be gone within a couple of weeks. And that was the only time the commoners ate meat.
Well, certainly that's true among commoners, and there have been historians who have tried to figure out the statistics of exactly how much meat your average English person ate, and much of it would have been bacon from pigs, which are cheaper animals to keep. The aristocrats would have had greater amounts of access to beef, although not every day. One of the interesting things is, at least within the context of Europe, the English and the Dutch, I believe, are the two peoples who would have had the highest quantities of meat, and also dairy products is the other element here,
mm-hmm.
In their diets. What's interesting is because the colonists bring over these domestic animals and raise them in such numbers, there is some evidence to suggest English colonists in the New World probably ate more meat on a more regular schedule than English people did in the 17th century.
I think that's quite probable. Actually, I was thinking of the 1400s and earlier when I said hunting was actually an economic activity. Actually, by 1400, I think the agricultural revolution had started, and there was probably more meat even for the commoner. But in the High Middle Ages and earlier, there was very little meat in the Northern European diet. There just wasn't mechanical means of preparing fodder for the winter.
Right. Well, I'm afraid I'm not an expert on high medieval England, so I can't speak to that. And I'm sure you're right on that. And all I know is that certainly by the 17th century, venison in particular was thought to be a kind of luxury
mm-hmm.
meat.
It's an interesting insight into the difference in attitude between the Indian and the settler.
Yes, exactly.
Very interesting. The way you describe the dogs in the east among the eastern Indians, that sounds very much like the state some of the people are describing as the domestication of the dog or the wolf, really, and it's becoming a dog.
Yeah, it extends quite far back. I think as much as 10,000 years ago, archaeologists are able to distinguish between the remains of animals that can be identified as wolves and ones as dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So the distinction goes far back. But one of the odd facts I discovered about this is these one piece of evidence that these Indian dogs were not fully domesticated, as they were described as howling rather than barking. Oh. And apparently only fully domesticated dogs bark.
That's supposed to be true. Well, thank you. It's most interesting.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're looking at how it is that domestic animals helped or certainly played a role in the shaping of early America. And our guest is Virginia DeJohn Anderson. She's Associate Professor of History at University of Colorado Boulder and is author of an entire book that explores this subject. It's titled Creatures of Empire, and that's published by the Oxford University Press. And if you're interested, you can seek it out. And questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have talked about the animal as being sort of an agent of conflict or a reason for conflict between native people and between the Europeans, and about the fact that the Europeans had a tendency to let the animals wander because they had plenty to do and the animals could sort of take care of themselves, and that got that caused trouble between the Europeans and the Indians. If the animals belonging to the Europeans would happen to wander into Indian farm fields and chow down, but I think you also make the argument that that perhaps the Europeans didn't fully appreciate just how much land would be required for this kind of animal husbandry that they had in mind, and that there may indeed have been a kind of a deliberate use of animals, or at least allowing them to just do what they were going to do, as a way of almost making the taking of Indian land inevitable. And that certainly was, it does get us around to the conflict over land.
Oh, exactly. One of the issues that's involved here comes back to your original question about environmental contexts for studying history. And if we can step back a bit, these English colonists who are coming to the New World are coming from an England where the landscape has been sculpted for centuries to suit livestock, the keeping of livestock. So you have enclosed pastures. You have to a certain extent by this point, an effort to raise certain kinds of particularly nutritious grasses in those pastures. And so you can feed a larger number of animals on a smaller pasture in England just because it's been prepared in this way and sustain those herds. When the colonists do come to the New World, they don't have time. They're building their houses, they're building their fences, and so on. They don't have the time to enclose pastures for their animals, and so they do let them wander at large. In the Chesapeake area, they're at large pretty much all year round. In New England, they do have to bring them in during the winter or else they're not going to survive. But these animals are left to their own devices, and what they're doing is subsisting on what natural grasses exist in the New World, natural grasses that have evolved over centuries without animals being present. These grasses are, by and large, less nutritious and so on, and so the animals have to basically eat a lot more of this grass to get what nutrients they need, and so they do expand out over large amounts of land. The colonists had no idea about this. I think when they came over, they assumed that they were simply going to be able to replicate English practices, but it doesn't work that way. So these animals are occupying much more land than the colonists expected. And this helps explain the puzzle, which has always appeared when you look at some of the very early settlements in New England, where you have settlers in places like Cambridge, Massachusetts, where the town is 3 or 4 years old. There may be a couple of hundred people there. It's a fairly large town in terms of geographical extent. And these colonists are petitioning the local government for more land because they say they're running out of room. And you sort of look at it and think, well, how can they be running out of room? Well, it's not the people who are running out of room. It's the animals that are running out of room because you need so much more acreage. There are various statistics that are given as estimates, but maybe 5 to 10 times more land if it's just natural meadow to sustain livestock than an English pasture. So at first this spreading out of the animals is simply an adaptation on the part of the colonists to raise the animals they need to live as they wish to live. What you describe as this process of the deliberate deployment of animals on Indian land is something that develops over the course of the 17th century. It is much more frequent by the 1660s and 1670s than it was earlier, in part because relations of with Indians and other aspects have deteriorated by that point in time. Also because this isn't a time when a second generation of colonists are maturing, young men and women who will be going out and starting their own farms. For those farms, they're going to need livestock. For those livestock, they're going to need a lot more land. So there's a demographic pressure that's occurring on the part of the English. But it is certainly combined with a greater amount of, shall we say, assertiveness on the part of the colonists to occupy land that they had once been willing to try to share with Indians.
We have some other callers. Let's talk with them. We have two in Champaign, starting with line one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned Australia. I'm thinking there's some parallels with the extinction of Aboriginals in Tasmania, where agriculturalists moved in and occupied the more fertile land, and the Aboriginals would, who basically Stone Age people, would move in and hunt on the cattle and then get lynched and exterminated, so that the extinction rate was very, very rapid. And so I see some parallels, but very interesting.
Yeah, and what's interesting, too, is the argument, the justification, as I understand it, that the English or European settlers in Australia used to appropriate the land is exactly the same thing you see in colonial America, which is the indigenous peoples are not using it properly.
Yes. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And on to another caller. This is also Champaign, I believe, here, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. This is a fascinating conversation in the big picture. But there's two details that just kind of piqued my interest, and I hope they're not too minute points to ask about. But the first is you mentioned this wolf bounty in Virginia, whereby Indians were encouraged to exchange 8 wolves for 1 cow. And I'm just wondering how successful that was, because it seems an odd transaction, with the presumption that the wolf was something that the Indians had learned to sort of live with and valued somewhat. I'm assuming had some spiritual presence in their cosmology and stuff like that, in exchange for this cow, which you've been explaining really made no sense in their system. I'm just wondering how often people actually went in for that transaction.
It's hard to tell exactly, because records weren't kept of that sort of thing. And it's true that Indians did see wolves as having spiritual power, particularly black wolves, apparently, because they were quite rare, and rarity was something that seemed to be an indicator of spiritual power. Indians certainly were doing some wolf hunting, as far as we know. And although Indians did perceive wolves and other animals as having this spiritual connection, they were also willing, as I understand it, if they found a wolf eating the carcass of a deer which had been caught in a trap, that they would kill the wolf as a predator in that particular instance. So they weren't familiar with the idea of killing wolves as predators.
Okay. And then the other question is the relationship of dogs that you described earlier was interesting to me. And then to say that the Indian dogs were semi-wild. I know a little bit about, you know, communities where there are semi-wild dogs, and they're breeding a lot, so you get more down to the sort of medium-sized standard dog, away from all the sort of the freakish breeds that have been selectively bred in Europe. And so I'm just wondering also what, this is a really silly question, but what sorts of dogs the colonists brought with them, and if they were so, I think they would have seemed very strange beasts to the Indians, having seen this sort of average wild dog all their experience, and then seeing these very selectively bred European dogs that could be very large or very small and had very specialized uses.
That's not a silly question at all, because so far as we know of what kinds of dogs the English brought, the ones that are described most specifically in the records are wolfhounds.
Oh, wow.
And they are on occasion turned against Indians, used to attack Indians. And clearly the Indians were frightened of these creatures, because they were so much larger than the dogs the Indians were used to.
Oh, okay. Well, Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. We are getting very close to the end of our time, and I think it's quite a fascinating story. Are there? I don't know if this is straining to make a connection, but do you think there are any lessons for our time and in our learning this story?
That's an excellent question, and one I've thought about a lot, because there's a sense in which studying this subject, the tendency is to blame the Europeans. I mean, and there's a lot that is certainly troubling in their behavior with regard to the Indians. But one of the things that struck me as most tragic about this story is that at base, what we have here are two groups of peoples occupying the same land but trying to do it according to their own ways of life. And those two processes come into conflict. The colonists did not bring animals to antagonize Indians, and yet that ends up being where the story goes. And so I think it just to remind us of the unintended consequences of actions that we take, and we may be doing things with the best wishes in the world, but it doesn't work out that way.
Well, if you're interested in reading more on this story, look for the book. It's titled Creatures of Empire, How Domestic Animals Transformed Early America, published by the Oxford University Press, by our guest, Virginia John Anderson. She is Associate Professor of History, University of Colorado Boulder. And Professor Anderson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The broadcast today supported in part by the Prairie Ensemble, which plays Beethoven's Eroica Symphony tonight, January 28th, 7:30 p.m. at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. The program features violinist Donwen Jung and Bernstein's Serenade After Plato's Symposium with a work by Adolphus Hailstork called My Lord, What a Morning, Elegies on the Death of Martin Luther King, Jr. More information available at 355-9077 or at prairieensemble.org. The broadcast today also made possible by grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll be joined by Georgetown University law professor Mark Tushnet. He'll join us to talk about the record of the Rehnquist Court. Tushnet is the author about the court's, a book about the court's 18-year record, the title A Court Divided. He joins us at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look now at what is happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat, 289, down 1/2. May, 296.5, down 1. March corn, 195.75, unchanged. May, 203.5, down 1/4. Make that up 1/4. July corn, 210.75, unchanged. December, 228, unchanged. March soybeans, 514.25, down 1.5. May, 513.25, down 3/4. November, 531.25, unchanged. March meal, 154.30, that down 60. March oil, 1936, down 7. March feeders, $100.30.